felony charge. I would ask the court if would like me to go into some background of the case, or if the court has questions that the court would like me to go into and answer.
Well, if you whatever background you think is important for us, I'm sure we'll jump in as soon as if questions become apparent.
Absolutely. Thank you. As an attorney, this is an interesting case because it compelled me or pushed me to look at the model penal code because of this case in particular and other ones that I've seen. There was an issue of, is kidnapping properly charged in this case? Because it seems that there needs to be more than just an allegation of that there was, this is kidnapping based on a bodily injury crime or a sexual assault crime. And that type of kidnapping, as opposed to the more traditional, that somebody is taken and held for ransom and like a Charles Lindbergh, that kind of thing. This is.
I'm sorry to interrupt you, but you said sexual assault. Doesn't it say sexual offense?
Sexual offense, yes, you're correct.
Well, what if you would address the differences between the model penal code and Hawaii's version of kidnapping, and certainly as per your briefing, there's elements in the plain language of the model penal code and in the commentary that seem to support your argument, but the actual language of the Hawaii statute appears to be different, and the legislative history doesn't seem to suggest the same kinds of concerns that exist in the model penal code. But if you could address that issue, why?
Yes. The model penal code, the way that I have interpreted that and look at it, is kidnapping, they were concerned with whether it would be too broadly applied. And so it is a prohibition against. The important issue here is the restraint and the substantially interfering with a person's liberty. And kidnapping looked at confinement, and it looked at mobility, moving somebody from one point to another. And Hawaii statute seems to be closer to the New York statute, which was centered around the definition of restraint or restraint. And the idea was to prohibit conduct causing intentional and unlawful restriction of a person's movements that substantially interfere with liberty. So that presents an issue when government chooses to charge a bodily injury or a sexual offense crime, but then they dismiss it. The question is there is restraint just within those crimes?
Can you tell me the background on how this charge was dismissed, the assault third?
It was dismissed right before trial. And
are you sure?
My recollection is that it was dismissed before trial.
Well, what day did trial start?
It was in December of 2016.
How about December 12th? Would that seem to be the date?
Yes. Yes.
What was the date of the dismissal?
I don't have that right in front of me.
How about December 13th? Trial had started.
Well, Justice Park, if you put the mic closer.
Trial had started. The document may have been submitted before, but the trial had started. I mean, it looks like to me, the date of the filing is December 13th.
If my recollection is correct, is I believe there was an agreement on the record to dismiss the assault charge. So I don't believe it was read to the jury. And then what happened is they followed up with the order to dismiss the charge. But that presents issues in and of itself because it is as if the government wanted to avoid a merger argument. And they also wanted to, what's interesting is, why did they charge an assault three if a big basis of their argument was to allege that there was a sexual offense that occurred? And perhaps that was to make the jury more angry at the events that occurred, or perhaps it was just that the complaining witness maybe they got to spend more time with the complaining witness. And clearly, I didn't raise any issues because that was discussed in the grand jury transcript. And I think the prosecutor does have discretion on how they approach their case and the arguments that they make. However, in this case, we'd say it is unfair, and from an evidence standpoint, because it is as if they took the restraint, which is normally within a bodily injury. The Model Penal Code says that all crimes of bodily injury or sexual offense crimes have some bit of restraint or confinement. And the question is with a kidnapping, it needs to be so much more. It needs to be such that it was done in a way to seclude the person, to help the perpetrator get away with the crime. The restraint and the infringement on liberty has to be much more than the incidental crime.
But is that what the statute says? In what way is it your contention that there was insufficient evidence to establish the elements required for
yes.
kidnapping? And,
yes.
and why don't you address how so?
We submit to the court that it is because the definitions of kidnapping has that a person commits the offense of kidnapping if they intentionally or knowingly restrain another person. And the definition of restrain is to restrict a person's movement in such a manner as to interfere substantially with the person's liberty. So the question is what does substantially interfere? We cited the Texas case of Hines v. Texas, I believe it was, and in there they talk about what is substantial interference. So they talk about, well, we found it in cases where a person picked up somebody and by gunpoint brought them into a car and drove around. Another case where a person made a couple come into the car and took them on a ride and then had them engage in sexual activities. So there was a confinement and a long period of confinement.
What about, please go ahead.
We don't require confinement in our statute though, right? We elected not to include an element of confinement.
I would respectfully disagree, and I would say that confinement is intrinsic and implicit in restricting a person's movements.
You don't think grabbing somebody and dragging her backwards 10 or 15 feet is a restriction in movement?
I would agree with the court that it could be interpreted as a restriction of movement. The issue
How else
is
would it be interpreted?
That it is it's intrinsic of an attempted sexual assault or an attempted assault.
Would you be making the same argument if there had been, if the assault third charge had not been dismissed or if there had been an attempted sexual offense charge?
I probably
and assuming that as with virtually every time a kidnapping charge is made and there's a substantive offense or a target offense, the court gives the standard language that the jury must find that the restraint for the kidnapping, the government has to prove that it wasn't necessary and incidental to the target offense. I mean, would you be making this argument? Isn't that the issue here? This is why this case is so unusual, is that the target offense is not it was dismissed.
Yes, I agree with you, Your Honor. I may have made arguments based on jury instructions because at least in our jurisdiction, the Second Circuit, I'm not sure that the jury instructions are strong enough and comport with what I've seen in other jurisdictions, which have squarely addressed the issue of the difference between the restraint and the incidental charge versus the kidnapping. But yes,
so a prosecutor, say this happened in Maui County, so if this identical set of circumstances had occurred in another county, the prosecutor didn't dismiss a charge that had been indicted by the grand jury, then you could have a situation where in Maui County, for example, where the charge is dismissed, the jury is left with, as Justice Nakayama just asked you, with facts that sufficiently support a kidnapping charge, but may not have survived an analysis whether it wasn't necessary and incidental.
I'm not sure that I completely understand your question.
Well, I guess what I'm saying is the result in this case seems to have been or could have been significantly affected simply by dismissing the assault third charge.
I agree, but...
It was agreed. Did you say that it was agreed to by both counsel at trial?
I don't think defense counsel usually takes a position if the charge is going to be dismissed.
I thought you said that there was an agreement to dismiss before trial.
I think the agreement was between the prosecutor and the court, excuse me, Your Honor, that would be the agreement.
Yeah, well, the motion, it looks like the motion, I mean, it may have been, it may very well have been served. All I have is a motion. There's no approved, it just says approved in this order by the judge. And I didn't go back and look at the transcript, but I looked at the minutes and I didn't see a reference to it. So it could have been done on the record. I don't know.
I cannot recall if it was discussed in motions in limine or if it was before they started picking the jury. My recollection is I don't believe the assault third charge was read to the jury, meaning sometimes they read, or I believe they read the charges to the jury before they start.
But was there any evidence upon which the jury could find that assault third had been committed?
Those are always hard issues.
Doesn't it require bodily injury?
It does, and I think that at best...
What would be the evidence of... Okay, so maybe an attempt.
Maybe an attempt.
Didn't they define bodily injury in the jury instruction?
I believe they did, yes.
Well, then... Usually you don't give an instruction unless there's facts to support the submission of an instruction.
The bodily injury, may have been instructed because the government wanted the jury to understand the elements as they were putting the kidnapping charge forward. However, that's still problematic from our standpoint because they didn't differentiate as to how this was classical kidnapping, which should have shown how did the restraint or the substantial interference substantially increase the risk of harm of the victim.
Where does that come from?
Yeah.
This is from the Model Penal Code and from multiple cases, which I've cited in my brief, which said that the restraint, which is intrinsic within the incidental charge, is of a certain level. But when you look at a kidnapping, the Model Penal Code says we don't want kidnapping to just generally.
But we didn't adopt the Model Penal Code. So how do you address Hernandez?
Hernandez is.
That was about as brief and unsubstantial as it comes, wasn't it, in terms of the restraint?
Hernandez, if I remember correctly, I apologize, Your Honor, that's the case where the co-defendant knocks the woman down after his co-defendant.
Yes, the defendant this is up on, I think, on Tantalus or something.
Yes.
And
the
co-defendant is sexually assaulting the woman. She runs up to the car and he grabs her arms, as I recall.
But in that case, the facts of the case, I believe it could be harmonized because she had already been viciously raped by the main perpetrator. So the issue that the case was looking at was could the co-defendant also be guilty of kidnapping? And the court...
They didn't discuss any accomplice type of liability. The case discussed the victim attempting to escape from the co-defendant was stopped by the defendant and thrown to the ground. But that was the substantial restraint that this court found. So how do you address Hernandez? Are you saying that it was wrongly decided? Are you saying it's distinguishable?
I think it's distinguishable, but I also think
how?
That the court was basing it on a series of events, not just that he knocked her down. But
in other words, you're saying the defendant knew that there had already been a kind of rape that had taken place and had taken action in a way that could promote the rape, and also threw down, as I understand it, the defendant threw down the victim in
yes.
Hernandez, right?
Yes. It was a confluence of occurrences that happened, and not just based on that activity.
Okay.
Because the model penal code, we have addressed it in cases and said that Hawaii follows it. And with the kidnapping charge, it wasn't, on one hand, the government could argue we have a more liberal approach and prosecutors are allowed to charge kidnapping wherever they see a potential restraint happen. And I'm arguing to this court, and based on other cases, and I'm thinking that perhaps this court took this case on petition for transfer because it is an issue. Is it in Connecticut in the Salomon case that I cite, in the Alam case that I cite, these other state courts are greatly concerned with prosecutors bringing cases when they shouldn't be brought, that they're attaching it to any robbery, sex, or bodily injury crime, when it really the restraint is just incidental to that charge, because the penalty for kidnapping is so much more.
Can I ask you about that? I'm sorry. Justice McKenna. You sure?
Well, you know, the cases, the laws are different in those states. Alaska restraint is defined as in the model penal code. Aspartation and confinement. So our law is different. In terms of the kidnapping statute, our legislature chose not to adopt the model penal code. And so that's why I'm really trying to address, you know, why you think that this does not comply with the substantial interference requirement. So you're saying, like, Hernandez is distinguishable on the facts.
Hernandez is distinguishable, and this issue, this specific issue, was not clearly before the court.
And I want to point out to you that you keep citing to this Hines case, but it was overruled by the Texas Supreme Court. So I don't think you should be citing to an overruled case.
Okay. Thank you. I was not aware of that. The reasoning, though, is the reasoning that they go into in the case, I think, is applicable to the court as the how substantial interference, and that was the definition.
Mr. Combs, I wanted to ask you if you could clarify for me your analysis as to the significance of the idea of a substantial restraint, because I thought your point was substantial restraint can't be defined as just the incidental force that's used, incidental to the underlying crime.
It has to be
more than just the force of would be used for the underlying crime, right?
Yes.
Incidental or necessary to the underlying crime.
Yes.
And in that regard, it was my understanding that you were arguing that the intent of the legislature with respect to the underlying crimes, in this case, I guess, sexual assault in the third degree or a sexual offense, has been clearly demonstrated in the sentencing that applies to those offenses, both of which, well, I guess sexual assault in the third degree could be a Class C felony. But you've got offenses that clearly have a sentencing that's less than 20 years.
Yes.
And so if what's left, if you take away the kidnapping charge, what's left are these lesser offenses with a lesser sentence. In essence, I thought your argument was that the legislative intent of kidnapping can't be to elevate what would otherwise be an offense punishable by just a Class C felony or else a misdemeanor, to elevate it to 20 years in prison. It just is inconsistent with the legislative intent that said that the level of restraint that applies to assault third or applies to a sexual offense would apply under these facts is not 20 years. It's much less than that.
That's correct. You're absolutely correct.
And where do we see that in the statute? Just if you could refer me, where in the statute or the legislative history of Hawaii, as opposed to the Model Penal Code, do we see that?
I would argue to this court that this court could pull that from the definition of restraint and how that is placed in the kid. That is an element, and that element is proven or shown by an interference that is substantial with a person's liberty. And now other courts have said that this would be shown by showing that the act of the alleged kidnapping has increased the risk of harm to the victim, it has significantly lessened the risk of detection, and it has significantly facilitated the perpetrator's potential escape after consummation of the sex or the bodily injury crime or the robbery. So this whole idea of confinement or movement of kidnapping is that it is something more than just a transitory action that is similar to a attempted sex assault, an attempted assault, a...
Well, Mr. Combs, as a matter of fact, he didn't just go up to her and he expressed his intent that he wanted to have sex with her or beat her, and he didn't try to do it on the street. He was trying to take her somewhere to accomplish this, dragging her backwards. I think there's evidence that it might have been towards the bushes or whatever. So when you're talking about trying to secrete it or whether or not there's sufficient restraint to decrease the likelihood of discovery or something, isn't that what he was trying to do? Or else he would have just done it right there on the street.
Well, first of all, and her testimony was the one that was believed by the jury. That was her testimony. This is at nighttime, but it's on one of Maui's busiest streets, and it is on a corner there. And other case law, which talks about, though, it still would be an action that would be incidental to an attempted sexual assault, but it's interesting, the government didn't charge that. They went to a grand jury and put all the evidence together. They met with the complaining witness. They never even charged that.
Are you suggesting they were required to charge it? I'm trying to understand what went wrong from your point of view. So you think there was insufficient evidence. Are you making an argument the government has to charge or can't charge this offense without charging another one?
I'm arguing that they take a great risk by not charging the incidental crime or dismissing it. And my second argument, which the court may want to ask me questions now or later, is that there should have been a jury instruction, an incidental jury instruction. So
if you could give us that argument very briefly, and then now, if you would, and then Mr. Heaton can respond.
When they dismiss, because it was based on subsection D, which is the allegation that some other potential criminal offense has occurred, if they're seeking the jury to convict of kidnapping, they need to have a jury instruction to make sure that the jury is determining that there is that the restraint is more than what was incidental to the crime that they dismissed. I did look, and as this court's probably aware, while I have practiced criminal law my whole career, I don't practice on the trial level as much. I haven't seen another case. I could not find a reported case that's gone up on appeal when the government has dismissed the companion incidental charge. And they have a higher burden, especially in a case like this, where the complaining witness wasn't taken to another location. And unfortunately, perhaps they had a stronger case if he had completed his act, they would have charged those crimes. But really, what do we have here? We have the government wants to avoid a merger instruction, and they didn't want to charge an attempt crime. For whatever reason, the government always seems very reluctant, in my observation, to charge and to prove an attempt crime, because they think it takes too much time, or I'm not sure, it's more difficult, but The State v. Maddox, which was an ICA case, which was my case, said clearly they could have asked the court for attempted kidnapping or attempted sexual assault at the time of the trial, but they chose not to. I'm going to reserve my time if that's okay with the court. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mr. Higa.
Hello, I'm talking to Dr. Alan Higa, Deputy Prosecutor Attorney for the state.
Aloha.
As to the assault three, that was not charged with the contemplation that that was a target crime. It was a separate crime. At grand jury, after the screening deputy felt that she had gone through all the proof necessary to find for the grand jurors to find probable cause on the kidnapping, then started talking about an assault three with the victim. This is when she finished the kidnapping part. She then went and asked about bodily injury. Did you feel pain? And yes, my neck hurt a lot.
So you're showing us what for the record?
The
grand jury.
The transcript of the grand jury.
Which is in the record.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. I don't.
And by the way, no objection from Mr. Combs, is my understanding. It's not in the record.
I mean, something that's not in the record.
Is it in the appellate record, Mr. Higa?
It is. It's the grand jury transcript.
Okay, where is that? I'm sorry.
The date is January 22, 2016.
Where in the docket? I'm sorry, docket number?
Yeah.
Okay. But in any event, we do know that the grand jury returned the indictment with both charges. And can you clarify for me the steps that occurred for the dismissal of the charge?
Yeah, the reason you probably didn't see anything in the record or in the minutes is that it was probably discussed informally in a pretrial. Usually, a week or two before trial, I review the charges again, see what is it that I really want to go to trial on, and if there are charges that I don't want to go to trial on, then I dismiss them a week or two before trial.
Okay, but this wasn't dismissed a week or two before.
Yeah, and I don't remember why it was so late, but when there was a discussion about an agreement, probably as a courtesy to the court, I would have let the court know that you don't need to read the assault three, I'm submitting a dismissal.
But the dismissal, but it wasn't, you would agree the dismissal wasn't filed and signed off, at least by the judge, I mean, until after the trial started.
Yeah, but my normal practice is to have it done before the trial starts.
But it wasn't. And, you know, I'm not sure a charge can be dismissed after trial begins unless the defendant specifically consents to the dismissal of the charge.
I think it's after. If trial started on the 12th, mm-hmm. and the dismissal was actually entered on the 13th.
Right.
That would have been after evidence had started and jeopardy had attached.
Right. And you agree that you cannot dismiss a charge without the consent of the defendant after the trial has begun.
You know, I don't recall the wording of the rule as
well,
to whether
it
requires consent or no objection.
Okay. Rule 48A of the penal rules says the following. The prosecutor may, by leave of court, file a dismissal of a charge, and the prosecution shall thereupon terminate. Such a dismissal may not be filed during the trial without the consent of the defendant. And perhaps precisely for this kind of reason, in my view, I think one can argue that the defense in this case may have been completely undercut by the dismissal of the charge, of the assault charge. Because this case suddenly became transformed from what became a very, very unusual case where the jury was not required to make a finding whether or not the bodily injury or whether the restraint in this case, whether or not it was necessary and incidental to the assault three.
It wouldn't have been necessary for the jury to make that kind of a finding It would have been consistent with Valdivia.
If the jury found the elements, then under Correa, unquestionably, this is Correa's language, a kidnapping that is necessarily and incidentally committed during a robbery cannot be the basis of a charge of kidnapping in addition to a charge of robbery. And you can substitute assault three for robbery. I don't think there's any difference. That language has been quoted case after case.
Okay, if the assault three was a separate offense, that it was bodily injury inflicted upon the victim because of the force with which the defendant pulled on her backpack straps. It wasn't, if you look at the grand jury transcript, it wasn't meant to be the target crime. It was charged
Who's
with
determination?
The intent to cause...
That's up to the jury to determine. That's why you give an instruction. And whenever you have kidnapping and robbery or kidnapping and sexual assault, you give a necessary and incidental type of charge to the jury and let them determine it.
You're saying that's your theory of the case, though?
Right.
But following your theory of the case, I'm still reaching for whether your position is that there was something more than incidental restraint here, some restraint that was more than was necessary to commit the target offense, however you define it. Now I'm also reaching for what would you say was the target offense, because kidnapping certainly requires that there be an underlying offense that's least attempted, right?
So, an offense that was intended to be committed.
So are you conceding that this is the force used was just the same force that would be incidental to whatever the target offense was?
No.
Can you explain then under the facts how the restraint exceeded what would have been necessary for the target offense? And what is the target offense?
Okay, when he tried to block the victim said, "What do you want from me?" He said, "I want to fuck you." And then he says, "I'm going to knock you out." He took a swing at her but missed. So there were two things that he stated an intent to do, cause bodily injury and or a sexual offense. She tried to run. He grabs her, drags her towards bushes that are on the side of the road. So all those three things that the defense is saying should have been included in an additional jury instruction, you know, movement, intent to secrete the crime, intent to facilitate, getting away with the crime. Those things happened in this case. I mean, he dragged her towards bushes in order to rape her, according to his statement to her, to rape her out of the view of passersby and traffic that was in the street. Now, he also said that he intended to beat her up or knock her out. Okay, I mean, again, taking her to a place where they could not be seen could facilitate that crime as well.
I suppose
now,
it's all possible.
All things are present, but my point is that they're not legally required. I mean, they're not elements of the crime. Now, he's saying, oh, there should be these three things. Okay, those three things are in the facts of this case. They are in the evidence from the victim's testimony. My point is that the law doesn't require those things as elements to be given to the jury that have to be proven beyond a reasonable doubt.
What does substantially interfere mean?
One of the cases that was cited, I think it was Hernandez, there's a quotation from the commentary in which the commentary says that, we're not going to say even a short duration could be substantial interference. But they specifically said it depends on the facts of the case as to what length of duration constitutes.
So it's vague.
I wouldn't say that it's ambiguous. I think to say that it's depends on the facts of the case, I don't think necessarily makes the statute legally ambiguous. I mean, the court brought up the Hernandez case. Yeah, I mean, the victim was trying to run away. The defendant stopped her and threw her down. And that was the extent of the restraint. But the court found that that constituted substantial evidence to support the jury's verdict that was restriction of her movement in a manner that substantially interfered with her liberty.
Mr. Higa, I have a different direction. Well, that was touched on before, but when you said before, I'm sorry.
Oh, speaking to the police.
Oh, I'm sorry. When you said before that it was, you told the judge, or someone told the judge, that the assault third was going to be dismissed as a courtesy?
Oh, as a courtesy so that he knew he didn't have to read that charge to the jury during jury selection.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, and, I mean, just to give everybody a heads up that that's what's coming, and you don't have to read it to the jury. Also.
Okay, so before the jury selection began,
right.
The defense counsel was on notice that
right.
There wouldn't be an assault third.
Okay. Yeah, okay. And you know, part of the reason was that there are two reasons for it. One is that, yes, it would have possibly required a merger instruction. And, you know, assault three, the charge of assault, count two, assault three, it's a misdemeanor. He's charged with an A. I mean, do I really want to fight for a misdemeanor on a merger argument before the jury? It's not worth it. Secondly, it just clutters up the evidence. You know, if I want the jury to concentrate on the kidnapping, not on some misdemeanor. Besides which, the evidence of the assault three would come in anyway as evidence of the earnestness of his restraint. He yanked her hard enough to cause her bodily injury. That evidence was not presented, I think Justice Pollack brought this, not in the record as far as the trial transcripts, that the bodily injury wasn't presented.
You know, Mr. Higa, I understand why you would want to get a kidnapping Class A 20-year prison term, but as an officer of the court, when we have a situation where the jury may very well have found, if they had been given the opportunity, that this person's intent and the person's that the facts may have shown that the restraint in this case was necessary and incidental to the offense of assault in the third degree, found assault in the third degree, and the kidnapping would not have been able to stand. And that ability of the jury to make a what I believe is a valid determination under the law was eliminated from them by your decision. I understand it gave you a greater chance, but the question is do you have a greater responsibility to the system of justice?
It would have, if it's required for the court to give the instruction that the defense is saying they have to give, that the force has to be above and beyond what the target offense is or would have been, it could have been given anyway, because the element is, the third element is that he did so with the intent to cause bodily injury or subject to a sexual offense. And that's why the sexual assault one and sexual assault two instructions were given. You know, in order to find the third element, and I also did the RCO instruction was given, and I argued the RCO instruction that you have to be unanimous on whether it's bodily injury, or you have to be unanimous that's a sexual offense, or you have to be unanimous that it's both. So in effect, in order to find the kidnapping, if they were unanimous on the bodily injury, that is that there was an intent to inflict bodily injury, that's assault three, right? Because assault three is intentionally, knowingly, or recklessly causing bodily injury. So if that was the finding, I mean, my point is that they would have to make that finding anyway, that there was an intent, at least, to commit an assault three. There has to be an intent, at least, to commit a sexual assault one or sexual assault two.
I actually think there's more than an intent. I think there actually has to be enough to prove the attempted offense, because the kidnapping statute requires restraint, which by definition has to be a substantial step and therefore would satisfy an attempted assault third. So the jury did have to find minimally an attempted assault third here, and yet they were not given the necessary and incidental instruction. And you've just acknowledged that maybe the court should have given it.
Oh, no, I didn't acknowledge the court should have given it. I'm saying that if you're saying that the court should have, because it didn't, If you're saying the court should have given that jury instruction, but the court didn't because you dismissed the assault three, that's what I was disputing. It doesn't matter that I disputed the assault three. If the court has an obligation to say, look, the restraint has to be over and above the target offense, whatever you think the target offense was, that was already in front of them.
Why do you say?
I'm so sorry. If I could ask a question. What is your position on whether the jury had to be instructed on whether it was over and above? So this is sort of following up on the Correa case that Justice Pollack said. Was the circuit court obligated to give such an instruction? Because if I understand what you're saying, sexual assault 1, 2, and bodily injury were instructed upon. Was there an obligation by the court to give an additional instruction explaining that what happened here had to be over and above or beyond what was necessary to commit those offenses?
No. In Hernandez, when the court said that stopping her and throwing her down was substantial evidence to support a jury conviction on kidnapping, when in Valdivia, the court said that when the defendant pinned the officer's arm in his car and dragged him 30 feet or yards, I forget which it was, with the intent to commit bodily injury, the court said that indicated that that there's circumstantial evidence of an intent to cause bodily injury by the means employed to restrain him. So the act of restraining him and dragging him 30 yards supports kidnapping and it supports assault three. And it's the same act.
Are you saying as a matter of law that there could not possibly be a determination by the jury that the force used was just incidental to the target offenses?
I think it would be if, for example, if...
Are you saying that it's a matter of law?
Yes. Where it would be different is if we charged, in addition to kidnapping, attempted assault one, which is an A. In that situation, there would have to be a merger instruction. They would have to find that this was either one, not a continuous, uninterrupted course of conduct.
Well, then they'd be invited to engage in a factual determination that maybe would be consistent with legislative intent. Because help me with this concept, Mr. Hege. It seems if you accept that there's a factual basis upon which a jury could find that the force that was used was just incidental to the target offenses, then the jury is making a determination that the charge of a kidnapping is inapplicable. Essentially, the jury would be determining that the charge would be the target offense. That would be the appropriate charge, which would mean it would be consistent with the legislature's intent as to what the sentence should be, the penalty should be, for that kind of conduct, just the conduct that's committed with a restraint that's incidental restraint. And you can't add to that legislative intent the idea that, as an alternative, the defendant could be sentenced to 20 years in prison. It just is inconsistent with the nature of the misdemeanor or with sexual assault in the third degree or first or second degree.
I think that would be inconsistent with the court's decisions on this matter. In State v. was it Halimano, which was like the carjacking, the guy got into the victim's car, made him drive around, stole stuff from him. The court said the restraint was complete at the moment. The court used the phrase at the moment. The defendant got into the car and made him drive. The restraint was complete at that point. Now, if we add the intent to commit the theft, then the kidnapping is complete.
All of the cases that I think we're discussing, all of them had both charges. We don't have both charges here, and that's why the Chief Justice question asked you about the jury instruction, whether it was necessary in this case.
To say, not a jury instruction to say that you have to find that the restraint for the kidnapping was over and above the target offense. Whether charged or not, in my opinion, because that's not consistent with the case law from this court. But is the merger law.
Well, I'll let you finish. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt.
Right, because if we charge the attempted assault one and the kidnapping and went to trial on both, a merger instruction would have to be given, and there would have to be the jury would be given the special interrogators to either find, did the state prove beyond a reasonable doubt, not an uninterrupted course of conduct, or did the state prove beyond a reasonable doubt distinct states of mind? Right? And in this case, given the facts of this case, I think the argument would be that the kidnapping was complete as soon as he grabbed her and started dragging her into the bushes. That's complete. Now, let's say he got her into the bushes and started raping her. Okay,
we have this. Under your theory, it seems like every robbery case, we could just charge kidnapping because, you know, robbery requires force, and that would be enough to show the restraint. And in fact, it seems to me almost every assault third, if somebody just goes up and grabs somebody by the shoulder and holds them for a minute and then slugs them, why isn't that a kidnapping?
Well, but that seems...
And we could just get rid of the assault charge. We could take every assault case and transform it to a kidnapping where the defendant held somebody, even if it was momentarily, like some of the cases.
Well, that's what Valdivia says. I mean, I don't see in the court's opinion in Valdivia that the 30 yards made any difference. The fact is that he restrained him with the intent to cause bodily injury. And if he did, in fact.
But, you know, Hernandez does say that in terms of at least determining whether the duration of restraint constitutes substantial interference with liberty, it cites to the commentary the intent and attendant circumstances matter. Mm-hmm. And it's something, and the commentary says it's something like a reasonable standard applies. Mm-hmm. Hence, a short restraint in an area where the victim might suffocate or come to other bodily harm would constitute a substantial interference with liberty under these sections. So wouldn't at least an instruction along those lines be necessary when you have a case like this?
No, I don't think it's necessary, nor is it legally required, because the same concerns that you and Justice Pollack have raised is handled by the merger instruction.
And what is there to merge when there's no underlying charge?
Yeah, there's no merger instruction in this case.
Yeah, well, if you say that the instruction as far as what...
In fact, your answer actually supports the giving of the instruction because you said it's handled by a merger instruction, and we don't have a merger instruction here. So we need something, it would appear, to fill that gap.
No, the merger instruction is important because in this case, if we charge attempted assault one and kidnapping, he's now facing 40 years.
Isn't attempted assault one? You said it was a Class A.
I thought it was a Class B. Okay. No, I thought one was an A and two was a B. But in any event, let's say it's a B, then he's facing 30 instead of 20, right? And that's why the merger is important.
How could you have okay.
Right? I mean, if we don't charge the sex assault or attempted sex assault, then he doesn't have that further exposure. So that's why the merger instruction is done. I mean, he's not prejudiced by not having a merger instruction where there's no charge because there's no further exposure from a second charge.
He wasn't prejudiced by not having that charge?
Yes.
By not having that instruction?
Because they still have to find essentially the assault three or an attempt to, or an intent to commit the assault three or the intent to commit a sexual offense in order to find the kidnapping to begin with.
But without the opportunity to determine whether the force used was just incidental to the assault third or whatever offense you contend they decided was attempted to be committed in this case. Which, do you know? Do you have a sense from the record which target offense they were using?
Oh, no. We didn't have a special interrogatory as to, you know, did you find bodily injury or did you find sex offense? They were given the RCO instruction, and my argument to them to explain the RCO was, whichever one you decide was his intent, you have to be unanimous on.
Let me ask you this. If this was a situation in which a woman had a restraining order against her ex-boyfriend, mm-hmm. The ex-boyfriend approaches her, grabs her wrist, causing pain, and drags her for 5 to 10 steps, you'd be able to charge kidnapping.
you know, it would have to be, this is where it would involve the difficulty of proof. Is he holding her and dragging her with the intent to cause bodily injury, or is he holding her and dragging her with the intent to talk to her? Because I've had those cases where it's like,
well, no, I'm sorry, but it's in, okay.
If it was an intent to talk to her, that's not kidnapping. He has to have the intent to cause bodily, well, whichever of those kidnapping purposes of the target. But for example, if somebody is restraining, if a boyfriend, girlfriend, TRO is in place, and he refuses to let her go because they're having an argument, and he's saying, I want to finish this argument. She says, I don't want to finish the argument. I want to leave. And he restrains her. That's not kidnapping.
So if he was using the language that this defendant allegedly used against CW in this case, you know, I want to F you.
Right.
So that would be kidnapping then.
Then that would be different, yeah. But, you know, if you have a situation, like, I'm adding facts to your hypothetical, but if the facts were, I want to finish this argument, you don't have a kidnapping, unless you have other circumstantial evidence of intent to cause bodily, well, any of the purposes for kidnapping. Absent that, you know, as the court said in Flores, if you don't have the kidnapping purposes, what you have is a misdemeanor unlawful imprisonment, too.
Mr. Higa, your argument then is that you are not obligated to charge an underlying offense.
Yes.
And that the assault third in this case was not an underlying offense. It was a freestanding separate offense based on his causing her neck to, she said it hurt very much.
Yes.
When he was dragging her.
Yes. So, if you look at the grand jury, that was the purpose of the charging deputy, that it be a separate crime. But if you're going to charge, like in this case, a target, if you're actually going to charge what you're saying is the target crime, then why stop at the misdemeanor assault 3? Why not the attempted sex assault 1, attempted sex assault 2?
So if you had charged the attempted sex assault 1 and 2, you would have, would the type of instruction, is the restraint above that necessary to commit those underlying offenses, would that instruction, the Correa, I believe was a case that Justice Pollack said, that type instruction have been required?
No, I think a murder instruction would be required, but, you know, from looking at Halamano and Valdivia and Hernandez,
so your answer would be no.
That's correct.
Okay. Thank you.
I'm sorry, Justice Pollack, I think I missed the last issue or that you raised.
Oh, no, no. No, just in response to your suggestion, why the sex offense may not have been charged in this case and why an assault third was the location of the incident.
I don't think so. When I looked at the when I was looking at this, I think if I was the screening deputy, I don't know. I think it'd be a toss up between charging kidnapping and charging attempted sex assault 1. You know, given the fact that he made statements, you know, clearly indicating that he wanted to rape her, without those statements, it would be, of course, a different thing.
Very well. Anything else, Mr. Higa, for the court?
No, not unless there are other questions.
Very well. Thank you for your argument. Mr. Combe, any rebuttal?
Yes. Thank you. I would just point out to this court that the Hawaii cases, like Halemanu, they had confinement. That was happened in a car where the complaining witness was kept there and not allowed to leave the car. There was a confinement issue. And State v. Yamamoto was the same thing. There was terroristic threatening was charged, but it was dismissed because there was a jury instruction issue. State v. Hernandez, we discussed. I do agree it raises some issues, but this was a circumstance of events that have transpired. There were co-defendants, things that happened to the
to the complaining witness that I believe that the court looked at when they found kidnapping applied in that case. Valdivia is a little bit of a different case. That's one where if the court is inclined to take some of my arguments, that may have to be looked at. But there was confinement because the police officer was pinned to the car and did increase the danger to him, and the car is moving, and that fits that confinement and dangerous element that other states' cases talk about, what elevates a crime to kidnapping, to the more drastic crime. I would urge this court that, as other states, not that Hawaii is inclined to have to follow other states, but kidnapping was meant to not have a broad general application. It was meant to apply to specific circumstances of elevated danger to a person. The Model Penal Code says it shouldn't be used to circumvent charging an attempt crime. And clearly that could have been what the charging deputy did in this case, or for whatever reason that they chose to charge Mr. Sheffield or to seek an A felony conviction. But the Model Penal Code talks about how the law of kidnapping was not meant to. And then as the law of attempt developed, attempt should be charged when there is. And part of what Mr. Higgins, I hear him argue, it sounds like they wanted to say there was an attempted sexual assault. Even on the facts, the hypothetical questions to Judge Wilson and Judge McKenna, he's saying, well, we have this, but at best, I would submit to this court, they had an attempted kidnapping. They had an attempt. They didn't have a kidnapping case. And from an evidence standpoint, that's why we've asked this court to look at the concepts of restraint and substantial interference, and that there weren't enough factual elements submitted.
And with regard to the dismissal, has it been raised? Was there any objection at trial to the dismissal by the defense? And has the circumstances of the dismissal been an issue raised by you on appeal?
Have not. And Judge Pollack raised a
justice.
Justice Pollack, Justice McKenna, Justice Wilson. Pardon me. He raised a good point. I missed that. I didn't catch that. And that is a point. And if this court sees fit, the court can notice plain error that's not raised by the parties. And that is an issue, that if the dismissal was not filed until after it is violation of the rule and jeopardy, and that may be a separate ground other than what was raised by myself.
Very well. Anything further, Mr. Combe, at this time?
No, I want to thank this court for the opportunity to argue and for taking the petition of transfer.
Very well. Thank you to both of our attorneys this morning. The court will take this matter under advisement.
Thank you.
E ku iluna, please rise. Ua ho o malolo ia mai ne, kea aha ho o kolo kolo ki e ki e hana hana. This Honorable Supreme Court is now recessed.